gonna rock these shakes, gonna scream my name, make you shout now, honey, gonna make you shout.
Whether you're an independent artist looking to take their career to the next level, or you're a fan that just loves to discover new artists and new original music, Making a Scene has exactly what you're looking for. For the indie artist, we have articles on music business, gear reviews, recording techniques, and interviews with industry professionals. For the fan, we introduce you to new artists every day with our in-depth artist interviews and insightful CD reviews. Nobody gives you more. Making a Scene truly is the number one resource for the indie artist and the fans that love them. Go to makingascene.org and become part of the indie revolution. And now, here's an indie blues double shot from our featured artist today, Mick Colossa. And stay tuned for that interview. It comes up right after these songs.
I've been feeling down, oh so low, seemed like I had no place to go. Every move I made seem to be wrong. I'm tired of singing that same old song. This bad feeling, something I can't use. Changing my ways, throwing away these blues. I was slinking around, always crying, so tired to live. I felt like dying. It was all so bad. No matter what, every day was another punch in the gut. I knew I wasn't living the life I'd choose.
Take its course. I can't believe what this is doing to me, but stopping it would just make it worse. Cause whatever it is just feels so good, I don't think I would stop it, no, even if I could. Yeah, I ain't no fool, and I ain't no rush. Just going where this road take me. I know what it is. This ain't no crush, and
it'll either make or break me. You know I ain't the kind of guy to fall in and out of love, but whatever it is you got, I can't get enough. No, no, you know I can't get enough. That sweet and tender smile, can't get enough of your size. I love that little giggle, that feisty attitude. Fire in your eyes.
From his brand new release, and we got Mick on the line right now. Hey, Mick, how you been?
Well, I gotta say, I've not ever been much better in the long run. Things are going real well for me.
Good, good. Well, that's always good to hear. Now, you know, you've been on the show many times before, but I always like to kind of give our fans an opportunity to really get to know an artist by where they came from, their journey. So give us the Mick Colossus story.
Wow. It's a long story. We're going to need Peter Jackson to give us three episodes of this. you know, music fan, hardcore music fan all my life. I was lucky enough to grow up in a house with an older sister who was listening to rock and roll at the time. My dad listened to big band, and my mother listened to classical music. So I got a good footing in music. At the age of 14, I went into an appliance store to buy records, because that's where we used to buy records, because stereo equipment was furniture. And I bought two albums. One was Hank Williams' Greatest Hits, and the other one was Robert Johnson, King of the Delta Blues Singer. Been a hardcore blues fan since then. In fact, I got into the blues through Robert Johnson and then Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf, so that by the time the Allman Brothers and other people came along, I actually didn't like what they did, because for many people that was the way they got to know the blues, and for me it was them making the blues a little too white for me, frankly.
Okay.
I started playing, you know, I started in the band, high school band. I played drums. I very quickly decided I needed a guitar because they're easier to carry along than drums.
Oh, yeah, and of course the girls like that better, you know.
Yeah. So, you know, I played guitar. I did some, you know, played with a couple of bands, drums, and eventually played bass with some rock bands, but I was always doing a lot of solo stuff. Ended up in the Army, where I continued to perform. Married someone I was stationed with, and we had 46 amazing years together. I got out. I tried to make my living at music in the 70s, but I also realized I needed to feed my family, so I ended up going to school and ended up doing pretty well. I left professional music behind, but I never left music behind. Got degrees in economics and epidemiology and all kinds of other things. And I worked with pharmaceutical companies, as well as taught in schools of pharmacy, as well as schools of business. in the early 90s, I left a very, very high-paying job, took an 80% cut in pay to come to the University of Mississippi and never looked back. So I got a chance to really bury myself in the blues, which I loved it. Got active in the blues community here. And in the early 2000s, I started to perform with some of the musicians who are friends of mine. Jeff Jensen was very important in that, in convincing me to start to record some of my own music. And, geez, where's it gone from there? Just finished up my 11th album, just mixed it. The Christmas album called Uncle Mick's Christmas Album. Going to scare some children the way I do Jingle Bells. Because, you know, I love to take songs and uncover them, find the blues that are in them.
Mm-hmm.
After doing a couple of records of my own, it was obvious that I had learned through my own mistakes a lot of things that I could share with some of my friends who were independent artists. So I started a record label mainly to help independent artists get their music out there. And that's really where Endless Blues Records came from, was to help some of my friends who are artists really get out there and have a better shot at success. A lot of people will cut an album, if they'll want an associate who's constantly, send me your address and I'll send you my album for a discount. No, that's not how you get airplay. Understand that you do need to generally, especially somebody who isn't known, you've got to work with an established promoter, because you know as well, better than most, there are so many new albums coming out in blues over and over. You've got to have some sort of an easy way to decide which ones I'm going to listen to first. And those who come from through some of the better known promoters, I believe, tend to get listened to a little more quickly. And they get to the right places. So helping them understand what charting means and doesn't mean, helping them understand the purpose of an album. Is it because you just want to do it? Is it because you want to advance your performing career? If you're cutting a CD as a money-making idea, I got some swampland for you. The
yeah,
purpose
right.
of it, until your Taylor Swift becomes something else. And, you know, a lot of it right now is just helping the artists on the label and my other friends navigate some of the stuff that's going on right now. Re-released 4 major albums, COVID hit, and CDs, which is the way I get paid back. CDs are sold in live performances, which kind of went away.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so that was a heck of an impact. It slowed down my ability to help get any more albums going. But, you know, we've been able to make some things happen, figuring out other arrangements. And I'm blessed to be surrounded by, you know, some amazing artists and have them that I can help. And, you know, bringing on board folks like Dexter Allen, who's very much a known quality and a heck of a businessman. Dexter and I are going to be moving forward at a lot of things, including some live performances together, which I think will be fun.
Well, you know, let's talk about the aspect of the music industry and mm-hmm. you as a record company owner. You know, one of the things that has happened over the last 20 years is that digital revolution has kind of, you know, advanced through the years, and it has mm-hmm. redefined the music industry several times. And we're at a point now where the consumer, as a whole, really doesn't look at recorded music as a product. You know, when we grew up, it was a tactile experience. You had something in your hands. But today, it's not. It's something that's available on their phone 24/7. They can uh-huh. listen to anything that's been recorded over the last 100 years. You know, and that really affects the bottom line for not only record companies, but independent artists. What do you see as a way to create revenue streams to keep independent labels like yours alive?
Well, you know, it's really tough, and you are right. I think that what we've got is a generation that tends to view music as music, if you will. It's background stuff. You know, I noticed that years ago with some of my younger business partners, I can't work with music in the background. I have to listen to music. That's what it's for. It is not to just create white noise. But however, for many people, that's what it is. How do you get around that? I think you have to build a relationship with specific fans. You know, in marketing, they talk about segmentation. And you've got to understand, you know, who your market is, who the segment are. I know that I can't, the songs that I write aren't going to appeal to my millennial neighbors. Now, they'll be nice and say they like them, but that's not what they're listening to over and over again.
Right.
So part of it is finding out, you know, who your audience is. Now, do you have one? I mean, one of the, and you know, for a label, you know, we're looking at how do we find lower cost ways of getting that music out there? Because I mean, I'm a stickler. I want to make sure that the music that comes out on my label is produced at a very, very high quality. I want to be able to listen to the sound of it and have that sound not get in the way of me enjoying the rest of the music. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff that is done. You know, people can record at home. You can get the software to do it. But for me, it sounds like it.
Well, you know, that all depends. I mean, I've been a recording engineer or home studio enthusiast since the 80s. And, you know, if you can put together a really effective home studio, that can get just as good a quality as you did, you know, back in the day. I mean,
pretty close, absolutely. But what I'm saying is that, you know, when I'm working, I'm you know, I've worked with some very well established producers. I'm also working with exceptional recording and mixing engineers, and they tend to be two different people.
Yes. Of course, you know, mixing engineers and recording engineers have a technical aspect to them that they know how to interpret producer talk, musician talk, into technical twisting of a knob.
I want a recording engineer that when I'm working with him, and I say, listen, I need this guitar to, and this is one of Jeff Jensen's lines, literally, I need this guitar to sound like a freshly baked loaf of bread that's just been cut into. Now, I know what that sounds like, but I need a recording engineer that understands how to put the mic and the other things together to make that work. Then when it comes into mixing, I've got the same kinds of things. But whereas recording engineer tends to be a little more mechanical, a mixing engineer has to be creative beyond belief to really lay it in there. So it's that kind of thing. And I hear albums, you know, by friends of mine, they listen to it and say, that could have been so much better. But what we've got is there's really no percussion augmenting anything. And you know as well as I that a shaker or a tambourine can do so much for a song. But if I'm recording in my living room and I've got two guitarists, or maybe I'm playing all the instruments, I put that together and you like the way it sounds, and it does sound good, but it's not the kind of sound that I need to have on my things. So, and it's funny, and I that works against me, because there are massively successful albums that I listen to, I say, oh God, I hate that sound. But that's something that hit me early on. I mean, you know, we go back 50 years ago and say, the worst engineered and produced album of all times was the Rolling Stones, their Satanic Majesty's Request. If you listen to it, it's pretty badly constructed, but it's the Rolling Stones, everybody I guess excuses it. So I guess I have to live in Ricky Nelson's world. You can't please everyone, so you got to please yourself.
Well, you know, I understand it, because I get a lot of records that do, you know, because when I sample or listen to a record to determine whether I'm going to put it in my show or whatever, you know, I listen in my studio, you know, through a set of Focal speakers, you know, through my system. And I can pick out those, you know, engineering and mixing mistakes, you know, and it's blaringly obvious sometimes in my environment. And, you know, it can be, you know, it can make the difference between whether I want to input it in the playlist or not, you know. You know, I just read an article and I found really interesting. There was an article about how Spotify's expansion into the market has slowed over the last couple quarters. And one of the things that it brought up as a possibility of why this is happening is that during the pandemic, a lot of independent artists went on social media, went on, did live streams, and created content that their fans gravitated to. And one of the things that Spotify seems to center on, it's a very consumer orientated thing. It's a passive kind of listening where, you know, you choose your playlist and you listen to the artist. There's no connection. And they're saying that the future, in the future, there is going to be a platform that's going to connect artists and fans together in such a way that all this content is going to be made available to them in addition to the music. You know what I mean? So if you took Facebook, Twitter, TikTok, and Instagram and put it all together with Spotify, that's kind of where they're saying that the industry is heading. What do you think about that concept?
Well, you know, Spotify is trying hard to figure out how to connect artists with fans. And Spotify for Artists has some pretty interesting things in terms of lists and getting with other lists. And if you want to get into the data and really get into the information, there's ways that you can do that within Spotify now. But you're right, Spotify has been just, again, it's background music.
Well, yeah, that the Spotify for Artists and that all of that, you know, analytics that you can get, that basically gives the artist a way of determining their market. Where is their fan base?
Absolutely.
But it does not allow the fan base to get close to the artist.
True.
You know, Apple Music, my granddaughter actually showed me this the other night. Apple Music has this thing where the lyrics of the song can come up almost karaoke style. You know, as they're being sung, they're shown up on the screen. So you can read the lyrics as you listen to the music, which I think is just a really cool way of connecting the fan to the meaning of the songs. You know what I mean?
Of course, then, if that would have happened, Louie Louie never would have been a great song. Those are pretty boring and mundane lyrics.
I think a lot of the 60s might not have happened.
Well, you know, the John Lennon. Yeah, that, of course, even if you could understand, you people were looking for reasons. You know, there's an interesting thing as an aside, and it's something I've got on the one sheet on my new album. I purposely wrote some of my songs to be less specific and more vague so that people could make their own meanings from them. You know, as you know, my wife passed away last year, and I wrote a song in anticipation of that because we knew it was coming, called It Hurts to Let You Go. But I depersonalized it as much as possible so that people could put themselves in that situation, and you could be sending a kid off to school, or you could have just lost a dog or something, and it still still applies. So it's an interesting thing, but all the lyrics would be important to have that, without a doubt. And, you know, when we've had this talk before, I think lyrics, for me, as someone who came up through the blues, the lyrics are the principal part of the song. You know, blues is a verbal music form. And I said the music in the song is the soundtrack, not the sound. And so I want, when I'm producing, I want the music to accent and support the lyrics that are underneath there. So anything that has that out there, I've released a couple of lyric videos recently just to make sure people can understand where that's going. So I like that idea. And it's interesting, you know, to try to divorce myself from some of the things, looking at what Apple is doing. And I'm, and again, I get wonderful data from Apple for, I know how many plays, which songs, which are being saved and downloaded. I've got a save ratio that it averages, and it's much, much higher than what they say is a good one. But I do have to say that if you've got a million streams and 5% are saved, that's better than having 100 streams and 20% being saved.
True. So, absolutely.
So there's a trade-off there. But, you know, there's some things. For an old guy like me to learn some of these new things, like this release, Wasted Youth, actually was on Spotify's release radar, listed in the song Easy Doesn't Live Here, was the number one song on their release radar.
Oh, nice. Okay.
That's pretty special.
Yeah, well, if you can get on those Spotify curated lists, you know, that usually, can bring some, at least some extra dollars into the coffer, you know?
Trying. You know, and another thing I'm doing, working with the artists, is understanding how to manage the royalties, because so many people miss opportunities, and we can't afford to miss opportunities. Back in the good old days, when you could sell 20 CDs at every show, great. But unless you're playing festivals that are, I just got back from the North Atlantic Blues Festival, one of my favorites, great festival, and everybody sells 50 or more CDs there. The audience is just, you know, great for that. When I played it 5 years ago, I think I sold nearly 100. Well, that's a pretty good weekend.
Yes, that is.
That happens less and less now, and especially at the smaller venues. So you've got to look for other ways to do it. So looking at managing the royalty streams, where is your music being used? I'm currently working on getting together to look at sync licensing opportunities for the music in the Endless Blues catalogs. And I've got all of these artists, and collectively we've got a couple of thousand songs. Some of them should be good in TV shows or podcasts, so we're looking to license those out. So if you want music to be a business, you need to look for those opportunities.
Oh, yeah, you have to have multiple income streams.
And I think, you know, another thing, and this is a great lesson I learned from good friend Victor Wainwright, who said, I play music, but I don't call myself a musician. I'm an entertainer. I'm a performer. I use music to do that. First and foremost, I need to entertain. And nobody does that much better than Vic. Mm-hmm. And he does a really good job. But keeping in mind that your job as a musician is as an entertainer, not to thrill people with your musical prowess, but to give them a good time. And that becomes so much more important now than it ever was before, because people tend to not pay as close attention to the music.
Right. I agree with you on that. You know, let's talk a little bit about, because you also are a songwriter. Mm-hmm. When you sit down to write a song, what is your process that allows you to tap into the muse?
Well, quite often, for me, a particular phrase, and I can be working on a song idea, but until I have that phrase that really shatters the ice, I can't write the song. I'll give you an example from an album quite a few years ago. I wrote a song called I Always Meant to Love You. And I wrote that song because back in the good old days, Bill Wax was interviewing B.B. King. And he said, B.B., what is your favorite song of all times, no matter what genre? B.B. didn't wait a half a second. He said, that's easy. Willie Nelson's song, You Were Always on My Mind. So I'm thinking, yeah, that's cool. Then I thought about the song. And the song basically says, I ran all over the world, partying, having a good time, and you were at home, but I thought about you, and you ought to feel real good about that. That's really what that song says. And I know that isn't what he meant to deliver, but that's what the song says. And I said, shouldn't there be some remorse, some level of apology? And I fretted on that for a while. I will never forget making a left-hand turn into a parking lot of a restaurant when that line, I always meant to love you, hit me, and I sat there and wrote that song. Because once I knew where that was going to be, the song built out of it. Once you've got that basic line, you can write that verse, and as Paul McCartney said very well, once you've got the first verse, the rest of the song almost writes itself. And for me, so it almost always starts with, you know, a broad idea, and then a breakthrough when I get that one line that's going to make it happen. Now, that's not every song, but the majority of the time, that's what happens, is I get that one line that I can organize everything around. I've written songs lately with Low where I start with the music and then I start to fill in things around it. Let the lyrics catch up later. Okay. For me, if the lyrics don't make sense, I'm not going to just go with it because this sounds cool.
Now you had mentioned earlier about how the music has to support those lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and a lot of songwriters, they use different processes in order to find the melody. Some mm-hmm. like to work off a groove, some off like to work off of the meter and how the lyrics suggest. What is your process that you like to use that kind of finds those melodies for you?
Well, a lot of times it's going to be the groove that comes out of the phrasing and where I need it to be. And you know, honestly, I'll go back through this wide array of music that I'm familiar with, and find ideas and then twist them around a little bit. But I, you know, it's important for every song to have some sort of a little, you know, in musical terms, it's a motif, which is something I've heard very few blues artists talk about, but they might call it a lick or a riff. But it's something, it's an organizing thought around there. She listens to, you know, something that Willie Dixon was amazing at, was finding those little... Willie Dixon was amazing at coming up with these little riffs, little motifs that would make a song work. So we could listen to a song like Champagne and Reefer or... Backdoor Man, any of a number of songs that he was associated with, and they've got a little, you know, a little riff, a little hook that you identify with that song right away. And it's something the Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf did just all the time. So you hear the opening notes to 600 pounds or 300 pounds of Heavenly Joy, or Hoochie Coochie Man, you know what that song is going to be. And I think it's important for the integrity of a song to have that kind of an identifier in it. Like I said, it's called a motif in music theory terms. And so I work hard to try to come up with unique motifs when I can. I did a song several years ago on one of my earlier albums. The song is Walking Dead Blues because I thought the zombies needed a blues song. And I used the theme from the Addams Family, da-da-da-da, but I syncopated it, so it goes da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da, and that is the organizing theme through the song, and it works real well. And unless you know you're listening to the Addams Family, that, you know, that's not going to be readily apparent. So, but I think those kinds of things, finding that to make a motif that's identifiable for the song, is a very pleasing thing to do. There's an awful lot of stuff that's just straight 12 bar, 1-4-5, da 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 da. And that's fine, but I don't want to write a lot of those, although I know a lot of people who do write a lot of those.
Now, you know, you had mentioned motifs, and earlier you had talked about sync licensing. You know, one of the things that I'm finding is that it's really huge. In fact, I've interviewed quite a few artists that were into this whole world of music libraries, where it's basically small motifs that are produced in 60, 30, 15, and 5-second stabs that mm-hmm. are assigned to music libraries. And with the amount of content that's being created today, a lot of people are licensing these libraries, and the people that are creating these libraries are making good money. One of the guys, B. Christopher, you know, he does a lot of stuff for, you know, American Pickers, and he does, mm-hmm. you know, the Travel Channel and History Channel, all of those shows you see, and all those little segue musical things are big.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, sometimes that'll be from those folks who's, you know, the guy that did Alton Brown's Good Eats. He wanted to take something that was basically like Close Encounters of the Third Kind,
mm-hmm.
and come up with something for that that was easily remember, you know, five notes. And yeah, there's a special skill set for that.
Well, you know, I mean, a lot of guys, especially blues guys, they come up with riffs and motifs, and, you know, and they don't have songs for them, but they can, you know, make them into little libraries.
Good idea to put those together, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, we're looking at taking the Endless Blues catalog and, you know, building libraries from that, because we've got so many different artists that have so many of these things.
Yeah.
And see what we can do. I mean, I've got some meetings with lawyers tomorrow to see about putting that together.
All right. Now, let's talk a little bit about what's happening here as far as getting back out there and playing live.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, a lot of artists are having, you know, issues with going back live, whether it's, you know, anxiety about not playing and not being in front of a crowd for over a year and mm-hmm. a half, or it's going into a small venue and not knowing who's vaccinated, who's not,
right.
you know, or who's wearing a mask and who's not, and all and so on and so forth. What are some mm-hmm. of the challenges that you're seeing out there as you get back and some of the artists that are on your label start to get back mm-hmm. to playing live?
Well, you know, the two things you mentioned to me are the big ones that pop up. The folks that you know, I mentioned I was at the North Atlantic Festival, and there were some people there that was their first performance in 18 months, and in some cases it showed. In some cases it absolutely didn't. I mean, there was a band who they had literally not seen each other in 16 months, and they got on stage, and you would have thought that they were in the middle of a tour where they were playing this stuff every night. So a lot of that depends on the individuals. But I know that it can hit some people psychologically. I haven't played, and you know, that can mean a lot. Most performers, their favorite drug is performing. I've got to say, there is no better drug on the world than interacting with a live audience and doing what you're doing. It's just thrilling. I was talking with Sugary Rayford, and I were talking about this one day. You could feel like you're at death's door, be so sick it's beyond imagination, but you get on stage and that all goes away until you're done. And it's a very interesting thing. So I had a friend say early on during COVID, he said, I would rather die than not be able to play my music. I've got to be able to, you know. And so that's one of the things. But at the same time, you're right, you've got to be afraid. If you're, you know, if you've got a working brain, you've got to be concerned about getting this infection. I've got friends that have got long-haul COVID and can't walk up a flight of stairs. Well, that might be okay if you're a guitar player, but if you're a vocalist, you just ended your career. So getting COVID, even if you survive it, might not be, you know, what you need for your career. So there's valid fears there. And you can't be sure. I tell you what, walking around Memphis, I tell you one thing. I know if somebody is not wearing a mask, 9 times out of 10, they're also not vaccinated, whereas those wearing masks are vaccinated. So if I'm going into a venue, I'm looking at the masks.
Right.
Looking at the distance I can have. Now, I thought they opened up a little too early on some of the things in some of the places here in town. They had a really good system of separation, and they'd taken out half the tables and things, but they brought them all back pretty quickly. So I'm worried that although we're the highest vaccinated, Shelby County, the highest vaccinated city in Tennessee, it's still bottom end across the country.
Well, yeah, I mean, you also got to take into account that Memphis is also a tourist destination.
Oh,
so
yeah.
You're not really dependent upon the local population to stem that tide.
Beale Street is absolutely not dependent on the local population until after 11 o'clock when they come and hang out on the street, but they don't go into the clubs. That's just all tourists. But what I'll do, and I go several nights a week to different clubs on Beale Street, and I'll either try to sit alone, or I'm going to be with people who I know are vaccinated, careful, or if somebody has to sit at my table, the first thing I say is, are you vaccinated? Let me see your card.
Yeah.
Sit down, but you need... And it's rough. It's a rough thing to do. You know, we've got quite a few musicians who are quite self-righteous about not being vaccinated. And I've just had to say to some of my friends, let me know if you're not vaccinated, because I won't be around you. It's a tough thing, but I see some people run in head first and say they don't care, they're just going to play, and others are very, very cautious. So much depends on the venue. And I think a lot of the safer venues are having trouble keeping going. We just lost another one. The Daniel Day Gallery in Birmingham is closing its doors.
Yeah, that's the other thing, too. I mean, a lot of the, you know, you start putting together tours now, you know, those routing gigs aren't there, you know, and that's the bread and butter.
Well, and let me add to that, is that when any of the routing gigs that you can get, and we've seen this even in festivals, you're talking about 75% to 80% of the pre-COVID pay.
Right.
So what it's going to do for live music, it's going to reset those paydays for the musicians, and it's going to make harder for touring to pay, make it harder for touring to pay off. And, you know, I had a post on Facebook the other day. People asked me, want me to like their tribute band page. And I said, you know, I'm sorry I can't do this. I understand why a club owner would hire a tribute band. People will flock to them. But, and we see that happen. Well, I've had several venues that at one time were good blues venues. Now what they want is tribute bands.
Well, because it's a safe bet. That's the problem.
Sure, it's a safe bet, and it brings in the money. I can understand that, but again, it's one of the things that we need to look at within our own genre. What do we do about that? I know a lot of artists have started to do some house parties and listening rooms, and that's a little more controllable. You can't do that with a band. You can't afford to do that. But I had a very successful tour in Germany a couple of years ago, just solo acoustic, and you know, sometimes I had 8 people and sometimes I had 80, but the average was probably around 20, and it was a good tour. It worked out real well. But I wasn't paying to stay anywhere. I was staying at a guy's house. You can make that kind of stuff work. But so part of it, I've seen more and more people are doing kind of house parties and listening room things, and those are opening up in the air, a little more controllable, whereas just, you know, going into a club, living in Midtown Memphis, there's a big club right down the street from me that Billy Bob Thornton's band just played there over the weekend. But you take your chances in a crowd like that.
Yep, yeah, that you do.
Mm-hmm. So it's keeps it interesting, if nothing else. You know, there's not a good answer, but what we need to do is look at it. One thing that I look at a lot is, as we see touring starting to open back up, what is that going to mean? There's going to be new venues we've got to look for. You're probably going to have to change your set to be able to make sure that you're playing for, you know, you're entertaining the audience. Because as much as you want to play whatever the music, sometimes you've got to go, you know, a little off one way or the other to get music that the audience wants to hear. And, you know, good artists can do that. I know that for me, if I'm going to do somebody else's music, it's going to be my interpretation of it. My sets will pretty much almost exclusively original music. And when people come and say, you know, will you play some Skynyrd? You know, I just got to say, well, they never play any of my stuff, so what's fair is fair.
Well, you know, I really appreciate you coming on the show and talking with us. And we're going to give everyone out there a double shot from mix and release. And you guys may want to just turn it up open the windows. Screw the neighbors. We're going to have some fun.
Go for it. Make the neighbors happy.
There you go.
Going through my life, throwing out pieces of my past. My life was going well, then everything just crashed. I tried to live without pain or fear, but I'm haunted by what happened last year. So I'm trying, Lord, I'm trying, throw out pieces of my past. Cards that you dealt me, I'm trying hard to understand. What did I do to deserve this kind of hand? Started out bad, then it went downhill. I don't have what it takes to pay this bill, so I'm doing what I can to throw out pieces of my past. Things I don't want to stay.
some thrown away. Thrown away some pieces of my past.
Thank you.
standing here not speaking. Nodding through our tears, we get closer to that moment. It's been coming on for years. We shared the joys and sorrows, and we helped each other grow. That doesn't matter now. It hurts to let you go. That doesn't matter now. It hurts to let you go.
rock the shade. Gonna scream my name. Make you shout now, honey. Gonna make you shout.
Whether you're an independent artist looking to take their career to the next level, or you're a fan that just loves to discover new artists and new original music, Making a Scene has exactly what you're looking for. For the indie artist, we have articles on music business, gear reviews, recording techniques, and interviews with industry professionals. For the fan, we introduce you to new artists every day with our in-depth artist interviews and insightful CD reviews. Nobody gives you more. Making a Scene truly is the number one resource for the indie artist and the fans that love them. Go to makingascene.org and become part of the indie revolution.
Shout now, honey.